This is Pamela Banos, and I'm speaking with Jeff Wade, who is a graduate intern at the Illinois Regional Archives Depository here at Northeastern Illinois University. Thanks for agreeing to meet with me today, Jeff, and to represent your department here, and for allowing me to publish this on my Hidden Truths project on the Internet.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about yourself, Jeff, and how you ended up in this position and what you're doing at Northeastern and what you're studying, and you're a graduate student in the history department.
That's correct. I'm a graduate student, hence the title graduate intern, kind of a wayward musician, actor, voice talent guy who wanted to come back to school to finish his graduate work in history, and found my way into this archival work as not only to bolster my studies, but to help pay for it as well. It's an even partnership with the Secretary of State, who runs the regional archives with graduate interns throughout the state university system. So it was a nice place for me to land, and certainly endlessly interesting.
So you came from a theater background.
Music and theater mostly, yes.
And so
mostly music.
And so you were schooled in that, like as an undergraduate, traditional education?
Yes, to a certain extent. It never did come completely to fruition, but I did spend most of the best years of my young life as a freelance musician in and around the Chicago area, and got into acting later as well. I worked in radio when I was first in college as well. So I mostly come from an arts background, but was raised from an early age with a deep appreciation for history. So I've always been interested in it and wanted to pursue it when I got to be at my advanced dotage. So
you're not that old, Jeff. So what's your area? What are you studying in history?
In the program that I'm in right now, I'm not focusing specifically on an area. That's how I'm going to get my degree. I'm not going to do a thesis. I've taken another option in my studies. But right now, actually, what I'm focusing in, if you ask me this week, and specifically this semester, I'm focusing on African-American studies and African studies. So I've kind of enriched my background. So if anything, I'm probably focusing more on 19th and 20th century imperialism, and specifically on African, on how that affected Africa.
Do you have any of that information here at the archive, or is that beyond the scope?
No, that is in fact beyond the scope of my studies, other than the fact that the archive is on the same floor where most of the Africanists' books are here, but the library, that's the only connection so far, so no.
So you landed the gig as part of the IRED system, which is separate from your studies.
It is separate from the studies, it is.
So something that I'm finding interesting in part of what I've discovered through my research is that they use graduate students a lot in the capacity of when the state needs people to be doing things,
yes.
Which is a nice arrangement for the graduate students also.
Mm-hmm.
When I met with Don Cobb downstate, who mm-hmm. is the archaeologist or the assistant, I forgot her title again, which is unfortunate because she's also an interview that I did, and mm-hmm. what I've learned is that when she's actually the person who received the bones from the
right.
1998 excavation,
mm-hmm.
and there were graduate students from the Illinois University system who were
right.
the ones who cataloged the bones
sure.
and put them into the proper cataloging system where they are now. And so I find that pretty interesting.
It's a branch, as you learn more and more the longer you're around a state university, that it is indeed a branch of state government. On one hand, kind of washes the other, and so there are bureaucratic rivalries here and there. But for the most part, whether it's an internship or assistantships or tuition waivers or whatnot, the university system in many ways offers a lot of really good access through state agencies to not only bolster the education but add stipends and stuff. And all of us students are poor, so it's a really good option. And it's not just here in this department and through IRAD. It's all over. I found it all over campus. I mean, there's opportunities everywhere. So it's good. And they do use graduate assistants a lot and graduate interns a lot.
Which is good for both people.
It is.
I mean,
it
you're
works
both
out.
Getting a good deal.
I'm that's
sure
exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about IRAD.
Okay, the Illinois Regional Archive Depository System was set up in the mid-70s as an outlet for local and municipal governments to store their documents and their historical records and vital statistics, to take the burden off of them, both financially and in terms of space, and also as part of a concerned movement to preserve Illinois' history. Illinois Archive in Springfield is legendary throughout the United States as being one of the better state archives around. And the archive depository system was set up and housed in the state university network throughout the state, as really simply that, as an outlet for state and, excuse me, for local, county, and municipal records to be kept. And that's essentially what we are. And this branch here at Northeastern Illinois University only covers Cook County. Other branches that are sister locations at Northern, for example, and Western Illinois University and Southern Illinois University cover much larger regions with number of counties and number of different records. So,
okay, so what you have is related to Cook County. And if you go to the general website that has all the databases listed, which
yes.
I will link to the page,
yes.
you know, where people have arrived at this point,
yes.
they will be able to see and search online in different ways, I suppose, according to the collections.
Yes, it is. Some collections are indexed and some are not. But we do take phone requests. We do welcome visitors here all the time. And I urge people all the time over the phone and whatnot to check our website, because it's always surprising. I run into people all the time who've done a lot of research, mm-hmm. but somehow have missed an indexed for one of our collections that is available at our website. So the website's very, very well set up. It's a good resource.
For the documents that are indexed, it's well set up. I mm-hmm. was surprised to find out that you have quite a bit more here than what's even listed on the website.
It is. There is more here than is sometimes on the website, but that's why you should always call. Most of the website listings are complete. There are some records here through a number of different reasons that, because they were put here piecemeal, basically, by the city and the county, together, that sometimes our indices that we have don't match up with the record holdings, but there are always another resource for that as well, whether it's the clerk of the circuit court. I'm thinking specifically of probate holdings that we have here that are not properly indexed. So we unfortunately might have the record, but we don't have a good index to go with it.
That's a future graduate student's job.
Don't say it too loudly.
So can you give me an overview of what you have besides what I know you have, which are the Common Council files that I spent all summer?
Yes, and the Common Council files, you know all too well, primarily what we have here in terms of what gets used the most, and that's, of course, beginning to change as well a good deal. It mostly is vital stats and genealogical records that are used by genealogists. Wedding licenses, marriage licenses, excuse me, for Cook County and the city between 1871 and the end of 1900. We get many requests for those. We have a set of naturalization records here that covers right up into the middle of the century, about 100 years worth of naturalization records. They're not in their entirety here for Cook County, but we have a large selection of them on microfilm. The Common Council records you mentioned as well. We also have the Cook County Coroner's Inquest reports from the late 19th century through the early 20th century, which is also endlessly interesting for those doing genealogy work. Death and birth indices for Cook County. The Chicago Police Department homicide reports as well between 1870 and 1930, which I've found that historians and genealogists of all shapes and sizes are interested in.
In fact, Northwestern website.
That's exactly right.
Well,
Northwestern's website is also one of the resources for that. You will find verbatim on their website what is in the reports. So they have also the same thing. We have the actual handwritten reports on microfilm. However, there's, I think, a transcript, but we have the actual handwritten reports, which are endlessly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We have local, municipal, suburban Cook County records, or what used to be suburban Cook County mm-hmm. records. For example, we have Washington Heights, four boxes of Washington Heights, which now is comprises Morgan Park and Beverly. We have their city records, and in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we had a researcher, and very interestingly enough, who is working with the local historical society in Beverly to preserve an original pumping station for a well mm-hmm. that was put in down there. It's been sitting in someone's backyard, and this woman apparently sold her house or moved out of her house, and the developer wants to tear it down, and they were trying to get a historic marker put there. Well, she came here to our archive and indeed found the building records for this thing from 1876. It was astonishing. So I learned something here almost every day, too. Mm-hmm. Very interestingly, also, we have the Chicago Film Review Board records that
I
date
just heard about that.
From 1906 through 1981. And that is, as a historian, I was, and lifelong Chicago area resident, I was blown away that the Film Review Board even existed past the 1960s. But in fact, it did exist well into the early 80s. was the subject of a landmark Supreme Court case regarding censorship in 1961. Very interesting, but we hold those records now. Those are old police department records because it was listed under Vice.
So what are those?
Those are literally the film reviews of the Film Review Board that would pass films for public consumption.
So they would watch the film?
They would watch the films and write commentary on it. Or there are also boxes of permits for adult movie theaters or even what would have been considered burlesque theaters at the time, and virtually anything. And this again dates back to the teens, so it's before even talkies came into play. But it is the review board's records, and the reviews are just wonderful little time capsule for moral attitudes at the time as
it's
well.
It's 1982, so
it runs through the early 80s. Yeah, no, I must confess, I have not actually found much from the early 80s. I found stuff from the late 70s that was reviewed, but I know that there are some in there. Unfortunately, that's another graduate student project, which I would have endeavored to undertake. but we have a creative, inventory description of it that's very thorough, but unfortunately the individual catalog boxes, while they're broken up by production company, are pretty thorough. There are some gaps in the storage system, but that's another project.
Well, that just seems so separate and tangential to like your marriage licenses.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it is city records per se. That again, this is something. This is one of the reasons IRAD is here. That the city makes a judgment that they want to throw these records away. Well, before they do that, they have to go through a certain process. And is
that legal protocol?
Yeah, it depends on the municipality, is my understanding. The Records Preservation Act of Illinois was in 1961, and then it was updated in 1989, sets a procedure, I'm pretty sure. Maybe the lawyers out there may have to double check me on this, but I think it sets up a procedure where you, at least for municipal legal records, that you have to go through a certain process, that it does involve the state. And for those records, I mean, that's the perfect, that's why IRAD's a perfect repository for that sort of stuff. So it is does seem tangential to what we have, but then again, if you think about it as well, we also have civil service records here that date from the 1890s and whatnot, these huge registers, lists of fire department and police tests that were posted in the, from that era as well. So it all kind of links up together. And like I said, plenty of records of the entire city area before some of the areas were incorporated, like Washington Heights, into the city itself. So.
We also have atlases.
Lots of atlases. The Sanborn Company insurance maps, most specifically. We also have public works atlases, and of course you've been through those as well. So the one map leads to another.
It looks like you've got some rare maps here that I hadn't come across in other places.
The Sanborn maps, especially.
Well, the Sanborn maps are actually online now.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Through I think the University of Chicago, and I access them to look into the Catholic cemetery grounds. So. Well, you had that old Peltzer map, which was really great, that atlas
with the big
pages. And I hadn't, but they're beautiful. I mean,
yeah,
just
they
to
are
see
beautiful
them,
and
color.
Detailed work. Yeah. And whenever there was an update done, they carefully pasted in stuff over properties and
which,
handwritten
which
things with colored ink.
Which gets confusing in trying to figure out how old the document
is
because
confusing.
We're looking at this layered history that the new thing gets pasted on top of the old thing.
It does add layers to it.
And
it's
literally layered. And so when I'm looking at, and so I was actually doing some things to try to help me visualize the change, and I was taking Sanborn maps and physically layering them, like in a Photoshop program, onto an earlier map so that I could actually see what's happening between the
yes,
two sites.
Right, and of course that's the cover page for your...
One way that it shows it, where you see the cemetery map overlaid the satellite map. Yeah. But I actually also did that with the Dunning, the facility where the county poor farm was and the insane asylum,
right.
Which is where they reinterred the Potter's Field people from the city cemetery.
Right.
And then it became this insane asylum compound, and then a developer in the 1980s bought the grounds and started subdividing, and then as they were digging foundations, they found bones, which opened up this huge problem.
And here we sit.
And then David Keene was the archaeologist who did the excavation, and so that story became part of my conversation with him. So I found an early Sanborn map that had the layout of the insane asylum with the tunnel system that went through there, and where the hospital and where the chapel was and where the dormitories were.
Oh, my goodness.
And I overlaid it on top of a contemporary survey map to see where the houses are now in rows of streets.
Right.
And I could see, like, whose house was on top of which tunnel and where the chapel was.
Well, the
and
tunnels
was,
are no doubt still there
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yeah. So. Well, that's like a whole other
sure.
thing. So so who is coming here to use your facility?
As I mentioned, genealogists predominantly.
But genealogists
however,
could mean anything. I remember being
okay.
here in the summer and,
yes.
and a young woman came with her kids and her kids were kind of running around and she was trying to look up her family history.
Yeah, well, now you have amateurs and you have professionals. We have a good deal of people that had discovered and coordinate their trips to Chicago to visit family with a sudden interest to dig up some records on their families. That is a genealogist as well. And we also have professional genealogists, a good number of them that I find as an interesting, as a graduate intern, an interesting resource for my own information because 9 times out of 10, they've been to most of the places where we send people when we don't have the records. And they can give me a review as to how the people are to deal with it at various agencies, be it private or city or county. And the professional genealogists really are always some of the best people to deal with because they're such a good resource for information and most of the time they always have their legwork done, they've done their homework. So we have a good number of them as well. Also, because of the you know historical significance of especially the Common Council files, we have a good number of historians that come in here, PhD students, people doing postgraduate work. Either in history or economics even. We've had students in really from all over the country, from Michigan State, from Oklahoma State, and just in the last month, those two institutions have had either faculty or students here. So,
looking for some real specific thing that they were able to get to the
exactly,
document.
Exactly, or researching their dissertation, whether it was... you're forcing me into a bad memory spot here. I think the gentleman was working on literally contracted agreements for construction after the fire, and what fire codes went into that, and how it was negotiated. And of course, it was Chicago politics even then, so it's a multi-layered story as well.
Which is what's so great about these files, because you could see that clearly.
Yes, absolutely.
And you could see the conversations, and you could see the kind of bickering and
the
negotiating
right.
and the back and forth and,
exactly
and the resolution
right.
and the resolution or the thing being tabled and then coming up again, and then you see all of the dates and from month to month as it went through, which was fascinating for me.
Absolutely.
For my project, because... From my perspective in studying the cemetery, it's so convoluted how the information arrived in the present, and the way the story is told in the present. And so to be able to have access to these files to watch the story unfold was invaluable.
Yeah.
I mean, and if they really were burned in the fire, as they were assumed to have been, I would not have been able to tell the story as clearly as I...
And that's just another example. I was going to say, as far as the people that come in here, I mean, you can be sure that there'll be genealogists and graduate students, but you never know when, a lecturer in photography from Northwestern might come in with an unusual request that
right.
turns into an interesting exhibit and
right.
project. So that's what you live for as a historian, is finding out people's stories and what their research
right.
is all about.
Right.
It is endlessly fascinating,
yeah.
and a week doesn't go by here where I don't learn something.
Well, and I spent pretty much the whole summer here reading the microfilm, reading. I must have copied. Well, I have several hundred dollars that I paid for copies before I came to actually photograph them.
Yes.
Before I could interleave them to tell the story, that I came in with my index from my downloaded from
yes,
the
did.
Website
from
with
the website.
Keyword.
And well, and you learned to give me advance notice as well as to which ones I needed to pulse, which was always appreciated.
Yeah. Well, no, but that was for when I was photographing them. But then when
right.
I sat here and I was going through the microfilm
right,
one after
microfilm.
The other, and
yeah.
and you don't know from the title of these. Of the documents, what that's going to lead to. Sometimes it's a scrap of paper, sometimes it's a folder chock full of information.
Sure,
but
absolutely.
So just by the descriptive term of the file, the document number, it could be misleading. So I had to see everything.
Sure.
And so that's what I did all summer.
Painstaking,
yes.
to say the least.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Common Council files. You have here a document that from 1865
yes.
that presumably... I've not seen this before, but you've mentioned it to me before.
Yes.
Is the possible reason why we still have these
Yes,
files.
It is the, in fact, the reason, and it's always it's always great to put your hands on something like this. The chairman of the history department, Patrick Miller, here at Northeastern Illinois University, refers to this as getting your hands dirty. And this is getting your hands dirty in real records. This is a request written on city clerk stationery from August 21st, 1865, requesting that the city provide funds for the city clerk to buy a safe, a vault, fireproof, and a capacity enough for the want of this office, so for a decade. So he was basically asking for a size that would hold what he currently has plus 10 years hence. So he this was, again, requested in 1865 and approved, I believe it was September 4, it was approved September 5 by the city council, report of the committee to the mayor and aldermen from the finance committee of the city council. And this was subsequently approved to prevent it from fire and destruction. So far-sighted, to say the least, almost exactly 6 years to the day right. of the Chicago fire in right. October of 1871. So it is this far-sighted gentleman that we have to thank for having these files exist today here in our archive.
And who is this? A.H.?
Bodman, by my best reckoning.
City clerk.
Yes, he was. A.H. Bodman was the city clerk, if I'm getting the last name
right.
correct.
And so. Yes, it's a name that I've seen.
You've run across him before, yes. Yeah. So
there it is. And so what happened then after the Chicago fire? From 1871, they were presumed gone. Even in the literature of the day, the newspapers said all these records were burned, or they couldn't find certain things because they presumed them to be
some
destroyed.
Of the vital records, all of the vital records for the city, marriages, birth and disease, stuff like that, was destroyed.
Survey plats.
Survey plats as well. The city lost a great deal of material. The safe survived. It was moved, as legend has it, several different places, which is why that no one group of people at any one time knew where it was, presumably. The long and short of it is, and this is for brevity's sake, if nothing else, although it's an interesting story, but it wound up in a storage warehouse, and for 70-some years was apparently moved into this warehouse somewhere in between the teens and the 20s. And between warring political factions throughout the first 75 years of municipal government of the 20th century here in Chicago, plus a couple of world wars and civil rights movement and things like that, things got lost or distracted. Or if you think of it in terms of being a municipal government employee or someone in a position of power in the municipal government, really old city records from before the fire were more of an inconvenience than anything else. And perhaps you could even view it as an encumbrance to your own political motivations, shall we say. So it wasn't necessarily in their best interest to buy space in the local paper to let people know that the original ordinances and charter for the city survived.
It sort of surprises me then that since they were presumed to have been gone, that they didn't just make them go away, but that they kept them and that they were there.
I believe that it became even because of the volume we're talking about here. I mean, it's not like it fills an airplane hangar, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's a significant, mm-hmm. it's over 200 boxes of mm-hmm. material. Because of the volume and the fact that it just kind of ended up, you know, out of sight, out of mind, I think more mm-hmm. than anything, the more I've read about things, mm-hmm. that's pretty much it. And what wasn't out of sight and out of mind and what was being asked for could easily have been refused mm-hmm. just because, well, we can't find it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had to then take extraordinary legal measures, which mm-hmm. eventually is what happened.
Right.
I mean, this was a Freedom of Information Act filing that someone finally got taken down to the warehouse in which these places were held, which had at that point been invaded by pigeons and, mm-hmm. and all that. So there mm-hmm. was plenty of guana available to sift through as well. But fortunately, they were reasonably preserved and in some cases wonderfully preserved. And that was in the, I believe they were discovered in the early 80s. And they made their way, at that point, IRAD had only been set up for about 7-8 years, but it was 83, I believe, was the 1983 was kind of the rediscovery of these records based on a Freedom of Information Act request. And when they were discovered, they made a trip to Springfield en masse and were filed accordingly, as everything you see on the web index follows document numbers and filing dates from the city clerk. So when patrons or anyone listening is interested in looking these records up, you'll see a fiscal year listing, a document number, and a date that whatever document was certified by the city clerk. So not to confuse the issue, the date that anyone might see on one of these files does not necessarily mean it was the actual hard date that it was passed or discussed by, even discussed by the city council. And subsequently from there, it was they were lovingly restored when need be and refiled in acid-free file folders, which you have been hip-deep in many a time here. And then eventually, when this archive was set up in the late 80s, made their way up here to Northeastern, so we're where they belong, right here in Chicago.
Well,
so
they've come back again.
They have come
they've
home.
They've come back, yeah. So what's so fascinating to me about having, when I saw these documents for the first time, I was in awe at the state of them and how beautiful they were. That, you know, the color paper and the colored ink. And my favorite thing that I came across was that wonderful little watercolor drawing of the cemetery fence.
I was going to say, that was the fence. That's,
I mean, that this construction guy who put his bid on the fence, this was his proposal.
And it was his rendering, and they saved it. And with the proposal.
It's amazing. And it's beautiful. It's in such pristine condition. And something that I've learned from my own experience in the art making, the traditional art making world, and having to do with bookbinding and paper making and papers and such, is that any paper that you would find prior to, and I think the year is like 1882, is in a better state than the paper after that year, because that was when they introduced wood pulp into the paper making process to kind of make it cheaper, and and it wasn't as well, it was just cheaper. It was a cheaper thing to do. And so the documents that you find prior to there, I mean, these documents in front of us look like they were just, you know, written up yesterday.
Yeah.
The paper's hardly faded. The ink is, I'm assuming, it's the brown maybe has faded a little bit, but it just looks so fresh.
Some of the ink, I mean, it hasn't seen the light of day. It's been...
well, there's that.
There's that. Yeah. I mean, it has been... it is astonishing, but then again, you stop and think, well, if you put something flat, if you close something up in a Bible, in the family Bible, for example, a piece of paper, it's going to last for a long time.
But not if you store the Bible in the cellar and it get a flood.
That's the difference. That's why they're now in acid-free files. They're in a temperature-controlled environment.
But,
and I must say that I'm a little bit out of my league when I talk specifically about preservation of documents, because I certainly am not an expert in that. The wonderful archivists at Springfield, at our state facility at the Norton Cross Archivist Building, have a wonderful restoration lab, and they do a wonderful amount of work there in restoring documents, documents that have been water damaged, documents that have been fire damaged, and as you well know from your research, there's plenty that's been fire damaged that still exists in Chicago, and you open up the box and you still smell the fire.
Well, that's what I wanted also to talk to you about, because the first time when I was photographed the first batch, and I was like, Jeff, can you come over here? Do you smell this?
There is a wasping a smell of fire sometimes wafts through these documents.
That's amazing.
And
I mean, and in the careless way that they've been stored over the years, that it would still maintain, like they were obviously by accident, obviously, stored in such a way that preserved them.
Yes.
And it must have been a very dry and a very tightly sealed, obviously no ultraviolet, and no
That's exactly
other
right.
Kind
it was always out of the light of day, that's for sure.
But that, but humidity is also, I mean, that can cause mold and foxing and different kinds of, you know, aberrations on the surface of paper. But that mostly has to do with glue and binding of book, you know, so there's other ways that
Anything that absorbs moisture,
right.
And as you well point out, even, you know, wood pulp and paper does that better than old paper does.
Well, it's cotton. So, this is pure cotton, which is what archival
parchment,
means.
Right.
But that's all, well, not even parchment. This is like cotton paper, and so that's very similar to these archival folders that you've put them back into, because archival means in this context pH neutral, no acid, not too much alkali, not too much acid.
That's
it's
right.
in the neutral, and it stays. It's like inert. It stays in that
that's
state.
It.
I mean, I had just talked with a historian who was telling me he was researching things after the fire, and actually early 1900s. And I forgot which research facility he was at, but he asked to see some documents, and they told him they couldn't show them to him, although they had them, because they were fused into a lump because they had been in, they had had water damage.
There is a way to preserve those. One of the interns from IRAD go to Springfield once a year for orientation and training, and we get taken through the preservation lab there, which is a wonderful facility, and the people that work there are incredibly knowledgeable and have gotten very good at their jobs. There is a way to preserve those papers.
To bring them back, you mean?
Yes, there are. Yes, there is.
They're preserved in that lump state.
They're preserved in the lump state. I didn't mean to say that they had been destroyed, but they can, in many instances, be brought back.
Yeah.
And there are actually remarkably simple ways of doing a lot of that. And some of it does involve wetting the paper again to separate it. It's the only way to do it.
No, and I know that from photography, too, because emulsion is glue. It's gelatin-based, you know,
sure.
So it's inherent to draw in. You know.
But if we go much further in this, I'm going to either have to call my brother the chemist, or we're going to have to do something else, because it's stepping
beyond,
out of my realm of expertise.
But just seeing
a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Seeing these things in that state and knowing about their history, mm-hmm. and then seeing them, you know, after seeing them on microfilm, which is, you know, a generation removed, and you know, just like it's still intellectual. And then when I actually held this thing in my hand and saw it, and then after, you know, being steeped in the story, there was like this visceral reaction to it. It was just like, and then to smell to say that I've smelled the Chicago fire.
What you say is right. I mean, there's a real connection. I mean, if you grew up here, you certainly know it. But even without that, even if you're just having a passing interest mm-hmm. in one particular small part of history, mm-hmm. it's endlessly interesting.
And in the hand, it's like to see
to have
see
it in your
hand.
That's exactly right.
Not just my hand, but to see their hand on the paper.
Their signature, their handwriting, their personal notes.
Exactly. We don't write anymore. Everything is dry and cyber, and you know, it's like ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
This is like pure object, pure, like,
that's right.
You know,
you can reach out and touch these
things.
It's
beautiful. I mean, they're like art objects to me as I was looking. They're works on paper, really. I mean, the way it's like ink on paper, and then the gesture of the hand. I mean, I could talk about them as if they were drawings.
Absolutely, you can. Sure.
And you know
it's
what?
Not a bad comparison at all.
I don't know if I told you that, but I've seen and touched the Antifire tracks in the Chicago Title Company's archive. Mm. And
no, you didn't.
And
that's interesting.
That was only in the last month that I was able to do that. And so they have a special room where they hold those books, and it's in a locked room where they have like these metal grate doors that you know, so that they store them.
Fireproof doors, right?
And
absolutely.
As I was looking through those books, mm-hmm. I smelled the fire again.
Sure. Absolutely.
And when I was talking to it's Welton Pryor Jr., the guy who was the one who brought the books out and showed me as part of his job there, and he's like, sometimes when we open up these doors,
you get the char, smell of char.
The aroma comes out. Yes. I mean, I can't even imagine why that's.
And if you've done any reading about the Chicago Fire, and that's not my specific area of expertise, but certainly the scramble to save things in a fire, and everyone, unfortunately, probably knows someone who's been in a fire and understand, but understand that on a city level, when an entire city made of wood is burning in a raging inferno and has literally a firestorm creating its own environment mm-hmm. as well, weather environment, and the scramble that went on to save not only personal property but city documents as well. It's pretty moving that a lot of this stuff survived.
Well, legend has it that those documents were saved by an employee who buried them in sand somewhere.
It's hard to know what's right and what's not. The important thing is that they were saved somehow, someone did it the right
way. Another good story.
They put it somewhere where it wouldn't burn, whether it was under a pile of gravel or a pile of sand. Either way,
it
saved them.
Yeah.
So,
and it's. Yeah, I mean, those stories are interesting.
Yes, they are. If unsubstantiated,
but
they certainly are interesting. They came from somewhere,
so
there's probably a kernel of truth in them somewhere.
Well, this has been very interesting, Jeff, and I've enjoyed all of the time that I've spent with you at your archive here.
Personalize it. It's the Secretary's archive, the Secretary of State. He is the State Archivist, in addition to being Secretary of State. And they're just nice enough to let me work here, and it's a pleasure to see someone like you who enlightens all of us here at the archive. Like I said, it's endlessly interesting job, and I learn something new here every week.
Well, this is great. Thanks again.
Thank you.